Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, it's Brendan here. Before we get into this week's episode with Jonathan Haidt, I just wanted to let you know about our latest sponsor, The Monk Debates. As a regular listener to this show, you're probably interested in hearing leading thinkers discuss the ideas and questions that matter. So you definitely won't want to miss the next Monk debate on anti-Zionism. On 17th of June, commentator Douglas Murray, former MSNBC anchor Mehdi Hassan, and others will debate whether anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. The event will be taking place in downtown Toronto, but don't worry if you can't make it all the way to Canada. Supporters of the Monk Debates can watch the live stream for free. Becoming a supporter is the best way to make the most of the Monk Debates. For just $9.99 Canadian dollars a month, that's just under £6 a month for UK listeners, you'll get early access to tickets and priority seating for in-person events. Plus, you can browse all the past debates, dialogues, and podcasts from the Monk Debates archives. So if you can't wait until the 17th of June for the next debate, supporters can watch and listen to 15 years worth of Monk events. You can watch Sohrab Amari and Ash Sarkar debate George Will and Jacob Rees-Mogg on the merits of liberalism from 2023, or even watch David Frum debate Steve Bannon on the rise of populism from 2018. Whatever issues you want to explore, there will definitely be something that piques your interest. For a limited time only, Monk Debates are offering a 10% discount on supporter membership for listeners to this podcast. Just use the code SPIKED10 at checkout to get 10% off. That's SPIKED10 to get 10% off. So to find out more and claim your supporter discount, go to monkdebates.com. That's MUNKdebates.com. And don't forget to use the discount code SPIKED10 to get 10% off. That's code SPIKED10 at checkout at monkdebates.com.
The generation, they're so lonely. They are starved for human contact. And when you're drowned in, you know, texts and DMs and stuff, that's not really human contact. That's strategic. It's superficial. It's disembodied. It's almost as if you took plants and just ripped them out of the soil and said, here, grow up in the air, you know, and they wither. So again, it was so sudden. You know, in 2012, college students were great fun. And by 2016, they were all lined up outside the, you know, the counseling center.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Jonathan Haidt. John, welcome to the show.
Brendan, what a pleasure to see you again.
It's great to have you on. You were one of my first ever guests on this podcast many years ago. We had a great conversation in New York, so it's really good to have you back on, especially to talk about your new book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. It's such a fascinating book. It's been covered so widely around the world. There have been so many discussions about it. So I'm really thrilled to be able to talk about it with you today. I've got lots of questions, but I guess I want to start with a broad question. And I know it's one you've probably answered 100 times already, but let's start with who this generation is. What you mean by the anxious generation? For someone who hasn't read your book yet, who are you talking about, and what is this anxiety that you're trying to get to the knob of?
So it's people in developed countries who were born after 1995. It's not all developed countries necessarily. We're studying that, but it certainly is all the English-speaking countries, the Nordic countries, Northern Europe, Australia, New Zealand. And I guess I'll get into it this way, especially with this audience. My previous book with Greg Lukianoff was called The Coddling of the American Mind. And that book was initiated because the students who were arriving on campus in 2014 and 2015 were just really different. In America, we have these, four-year residential colleges, a little less than half of the country sends their kids to some sort of college. And at the elite level, you live in these beautiful places, you have fun, you drink, you try to have sex, you learn, you do all sorts of things. That's our stereotype of college students. But the students who arrived in 2014, 2015 were very different. They were much more threat sensitive. They saw threats everywhere. If a speaker is coming to campus that they don't like, this could be dangerous. This could really harm people. And we didn't understand. We just didn't understand what they were even saying. What do you mean? You don't have to go to the lecture. How are you going to be harmed by a lecture you don't have to go to? And we thought that they were millennials because that was the word for that generation. We thought the millennial generation marketers said, 1981 through 1999. They just guessed that would be birth years. But it turns out there's a very sharp delineation right around birth year 1996, plus or minus a year, at least in the United States. It might be a little bit off in other countries. And the difference is basically puberty. If you went through puberty with a flip phone, you're a millennial and you're okay. The millennial's mental health is fine. The youngest female millennials have some of the anxiety. But overall, the millennial generation is doing well. They're creative. They started businesses. They travel the world. I mean, I really admire the millennial generation for the way it just embraces life. But if you were born a few years later, let's say you were born in the year 2000, well, you probably got your first smartphone at the age of 10 or 11. Back then, it might have been 12. But the point is that, let's say you got it at 11. So you get your first smartphone in 2011. Instagram has just been invented. In 2012, Facebook buys it. And that's the year that so many young women move their social lives onto Instagram. The front-facing camera just came out. So now your iPhone has a front-facing camera and you have an Instagram account and you have high-speed internet. And so you are now going to go through all of puberty holding your phone. You're going to be looking at it a lot. And even when you're not looking at it, you're thinking about it. You're thinking about the drama. You're thinking about what you just posted. I wonder if it's what people said about it. So my point is that life for the millennials was still recognizably a human childhood. They used their phones as a tool to meet up with each other. You text. It's hard to text on those little, numeric keypads. So it's a tool to say, I'll meet you at 3 o'clock at the mall or whatever. But by 2015, they're not meeting up anymore. The time with friends plummets. It falls off a cliff. The technology is not a tool to facilitate social life. It's an experience blocker that blocks out almost everything else because now they're spending, 5 to 10 hours a day on the phone, possibly a lot more than that for heavy users. So that pushes out almost everything else: sleep, social life, reading a book, having a hobby. All that stuff has to be squeezed down because you got to make 5 to 10 hours a day for this new way of living.
So that's a really good outline for who we're talking about and what we're talking about. And I thought about the coddling of the American mind a lot when I was reading this book. I saw this new book, The Anxious Generation, as almost the backstory to the coddling of the American mind, the origin story of how all these things happened. And of course, you reference the coddling of the American mind a few times throughout this new book. And I do want to ask you about the role of technology and particularly the role of iPhones. And the way you've described it just there, a millennial with a flip phone, generally okay, a Gen Zer with an iPhone, not so much. That's a really good starting point. But let's, before we get into that, talk a little bit about the mental health crisis as you see it, because there's a really quite shocking part of the book where you talk about, you call it the surge of suffering, this wave of angst, this wave of anxiety, this wave even of depressive moods that seems to sweep this anxious generation, this very young generation. Explain a little bit to listeners how bad you think that has got in terms of the experiences that these kids are having.
Sure. So yeah, I'll just, you know, I'll just pull up the slideshow that I show, because I graph out a lot of the numbers are absolutely stunning. And so if you read the book, or if you watch my talks online, or just go to anxiousgeneration.com, we have a lot of we have a big long thing about the evidence showing these graphs. They're stunning. What you see, whatever you're graphing, if it's related to anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicide, what you see is that from the late 90s through 2010, things were pretty stable or actually getting a little bit better. So the millennials were actually a little bit mentally healthier than Gen X before them. Gen X is born 1965 through 1980. Millennials are 1981 through 1995. So the millennials are doing fine when they're the teenagers. All the graphs I show, there's really nothing going on until 2010. And then I do a big dramatic reveal on each graph. I press a button and, like, you know, a square moves away and you see a hockey stick. They're all hockey sticks. All of a sudden, especially for the girls, it's a very sharp hockey stick. For boys, it's a little more gradual. All of a sudden, the numbers go up and they go way up. Anywhere from 50 to 150% for most things. When you look at the younger teen girls, that's where you see the gigantic increases, often sometimes 200%. Rates of self-harm are up on the order of 200%. Hospital admissions for self-harm. Yeah, 10 to 14-year-old girls didn't used to cut themselves, but now they do. So what we're seeing is not a 10 or 20% rise. What we're seeing is a rise so big that if you're an American teenage girl now, it's just normal that you've made a suicide plan. It's not a majority, but it's about a quarter have made a suicide plan. And a majority say they have felt persistent sadness. The generation, they're so lonely. They are starved for human contact. And when you're drowned in, you know, texts and DMs and stuff, that's not really human contact. That's strategic. It's superficial. It's disembodied. So what we're seeing is a generation, it's almost as if you took plants and you just ripped them out of the soil and said, here, grow up in the air, you know, and they wither. So again, it was so sudden. You know, in 2012, college students were great fun. And by 2016, they were all lined up outside the counseling center.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some of the origins to this crisis that you describe. Which is very real. I don't think anyone listening to this would doubt it. When I go to speak on campuses now to the younger generation, the ones who are now 18 or 19, I'm always quite disturbed by how many of them not only have mental illnesses, or they would describe it as mental ill health, but are also quite willing to talk about it. They're open about it. They will make declarations about it. There is definitely a peculiar culture at the moment. But I think some of the critiques that I've seen of your book give the impression that you think it's all down to the iPhone, nothing else. The phone comes along and boom, everything goes down very quickly. And you do critique phones and social media and technology quite a lot. And I really want to ask you some questions on that. But you also dig into other cultural trends and social trends and parenting trends that have contributed to the rise of this anxious generation. So I wanted to ask you about a couple of those. There's a really brilliant section in the book on play and the importance of play. And you describe play as the work of childhood. And you give a really good description of why play is important, not only for human children, but also for mammals. It's the way in which mammals learn survival skills that will protect them in the future. And it's essential for children too. So explain a little bit about why you think play, even risky play, is so important and what happens when it declines.
Yeah. No, thank you for this, because there's about 7 to 10 accusations that are widely made. And some of them just are, you know, for anyone who's read the book, they would know it's not true. So the idea that I blame it all on the phones is absurd. you know, a third of the book is about childhood, about play, about overprotection. And a lot of the book is also about other cultural changes, the loss of trust, the loss of solidarity. So I'm a social scientist, and I like to think I don't do one factor stories. I love nuance. I love interweaving different storylines. For this one, this is the other major storyline, which is the loss of the play-based childhood. And the more I've dug into the research on play, the more fascinating and really fun it gets, because you remember your own childhood. And so, you know, the starting point is what you said, just that we're mammals. And that's just part of being a mammal, is the mammalian order came about when somehow, I don't know how, some skin on the chest of some, you know, females secreted nutritious. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know how the hell lactation evolved, but it did. And as long as you're lactating and feeding this little thing, you're going to have a much longer childhood. Oh, if you have a much longer childhood, you have the possibility for a lot more learning, a larger brain, all that stuff. So mammals have this long childhood, high investment. And what are they doing? They're playing, and they're taking risks when they play, and they can get eaten when they're taking risks. They're not with their mother. So evolution must have found it to be pretty effective to do this rather than just keep them with the mother all the time, keep them safe. And humans are the same way. Human children begin to explore, they wander away, but then they look back. If they're anxious, they look back. You check in, you make sure your secure base is there. And if you have a secure base, then you can go even further away. And that's where the learning happens. Not a lot of it happens when you're sitting there with mom, even if she's lecturing at you. The real learning happens when you're out with some other kids and you face a challenge. You say, can we cross this river? Can we climb this tree? What are we going to do? Hey, let's have a game with the kid. My friend and I got in a rock fight with some neighboring kids, but we formed teams and we had rules, and it was great fun, and it was risky. So what I really dug into on this one, because I have a chapter on play and the coddling as well, but I really dug into this one is some newer research showing the importance of thrills. This is the key word, thrills. Yeah. And when you're out with your friends, you take risks, and the possibility of getting hurt. That's why you climb a higher wall. That's why you climb to a higher branch on a tree. You know, that's why you decide to like play a hunting game. You know, my best friend and I, we had BB guns, and we hunted each other without goggles. It was completely insane. But, you know, but it was, we took risks. And it's when you take risks that something resets in your brain. Like, okay, I've been there. I've done that. I know my limits. I know I can do more than I thought I could do yesterday, but I know where so it's a gradual process. It plays out over all of childhood. And then when you're a teenager, then you're doing even more. You have to form your new identity. You have to reform your identity. So this is how we evolved. And if you take away that independent risk-seeking, thrill-seeking behavior, you're stunting your kid's growth just as if you took away all the vitamin C. Or all the vegetables. I mean, we need a wide variety of experiences. And the phone, the day you give your kid their own phone to hold on to is the day that they're going to put in front of their face. And from then on, the phone is an experience blocker. So, you know, I really want people to think about that. When are you ready to have your child block out most of the experience the world has to offer? At what age? It should not be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, or 13.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show. So in relation to play, and you've written about this at length in this book, but also, as you say, in previous work too, I wanted to ask you about the role of parenting, the new forms of parenting in contributing to the decline of play. And I think most people would agree that the decline of play is a bad thing for kids. It stunts their burgeoning independence, their ability to move on and develop the skills all of us need if they're not playing. I think the stuff you have in this book on parenting and the changing nature of parenting is really actually very nuanced, because there is a tendency I've noticed, especially, I guess, in the right-wing press, to really moan about parents, you know, these stupid parents, helicopter parents, which is a real thing, of course, and, you know, parents coddling their kids or spoiling their kids and so on. And no doubt that happens, but you kind of interweave the crisis of parenting with the crisis of solidarity. So one of the points you make is that the more that adult society itself gives up on the shared experience of looking out for kids or allowing kids to have that freedom to roam, the more that parents feel very much on their own, very secluded. Parenting gets harder as a consequence of that. And you make the point that's especially true for women, a single mum, for example, having to do absolutely everything. So there is a social contribution, isn't there, to this crisis of parenting and the way in which that impacts then on kids and their ability to develop?
Oh, absolutely. One weakness of my book is that I didn't critique parents very much. I didn't discuss parenting styles very much, other than the general overprotection. Since the book came out, I've had conversations with lots of people. There's an American woman, Dr. Becky. She's a psychologist who is an expert on child rearing, and she's very popular among millennial parents. And I one of the high points of my book tour was I was on a stage with her and Oprah Winfrey. That was really exciting. But Dr. Becky, one of her big issues is that parents need to set limits. They should not try to be friends with their kids and be nice and give them everything they want. Parents must set limits. Kids need limits. They thrive with limits. They just sort of dissipate without limits. And as she points out, if you haven't been setting limits with your kids all along, if they haven't grown up in a world where, look, this is the rule, and if I disobey it, there will be consequences. If you haven't been setting rules and limits all during their lives, and now all of a sudden you gave them a phone at age 10, and now you're trying to enforce limits and say, well, only 3 hours a day and not at mealtimes and not at bedtime, you are in for just constant fighting. So it's very important that parents set limits and structure. And it's just part of modernity, part of sort of a general shift towards permissiveness. And I think this might help explain why there is this really interesting twist in the data, which Greg Lukianoff and I have both been writing about on our Substacks, where whenever you plot out the mental illness graphs, everyone is up. Nobody has been spared. But whenever you contrast left versus right, it's the liberals are up more. Liberals always were a little more anxious and neurotic than conservatives. That's a long known fact. It's just a relatively small difference, but it's been there. But after 2012, that gap widens. So the conservative kids go up a little, the liberal kids go up a lot. Same thing for secular religious. It's long been known in positive psychology, one of the fields I work in, that the really big things that are always associated with happiness are marriage and religion. People who are actively religious, they go to church or synagogue, are happier than those who don't. They're more rooted, they have more sense of meaning, community, all that stuff. So that difference existed before 2012. But it widens after 2012. The religious kids are up a little. The secular kids are up a lot. When you put it all together, in some of the graphs that Zach Rausch, my lead researcher, some of the graphs he's made, the religious conservative boys are barely up at all, whereas the secular liberal girls are doing the worst of all. And there's a lot of reasons for that. We can get into that. Some of it is the bad ideas that circulate. But I suspect that some of it is that liberal, so there's three parenting styles: authoritative, authoritarian, and permissive. This is work by Diana Baumrind. It's very widely respected in psychology. And in general, in modern Western cultures, authoritative parenting is the most effective. It's more likely to produce kids who are self-governing. They can follow rules, but they're independent. Conservatives generally used to use a mix of authoritarian, which is really strict, and authoritative, whereas liberals used to use a mix of authoritative and permissive. So that's why I think we used to have the differences. But I think in our modern culture, everyone has shifted towards permissive. So conservative families are probably, my guess is, they're doing less authoritarian stuff than they used to 30 years ago, and more authoritative, which is actually pretty good. That might help explain why the conservative kids are coming out with better mental health. Whereas the liberal families that used to be authoritative, like, you know, my parents were, my mother was great at being authoritative, not a dictator, but boy, if she made a rule, like, I knew there were not going to be exceptions. I could not, this was the law. So if liberal families shift from authoritative and permissive more towards more permissive, then their kids are going to come out less anchored and more ready to be swept away when the virtual world comes marching in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a bit about the virtual world and the real world, because there's a line in the book, or a paragraph in the book, which was a real light bulb moment for me as I was reading it, where you make this observation that we live in an incredibly contradictory period, because kids are encouraged to think that the real world is full of monsters. Don't go outside. You might fall out of a tree. You might meet there's stranger danger. There's all sorts of problems lurking around the corner. But then, for a period of time anyway, it was seen as okay to let them roam around the virtual world instead, to stay at home with their iPad or their iPhone or their computer, and to live in that universe. And I know this from personal experience. When I look at my nephews and nieces and they're looking at their phones all day, they're usually just watching YouTube videos of young fellas playing video games. They watch people playing video games all the time, which I find very strange. But I find myself thinking all the time, what are you looking at on your phones? Is there bad stuff there? Is there dangerous stuff? Because I know it's accessible. I know you can find it if you want it. And I'm sure I would be far less concerned if they were going outdoors and doing the kind of things that I used to do and that you used to do, which was sometimes dangerous, but also good fun. So talk a little bit about that contradictory, where some people are so fearful of the real world and so trusting of the virtual world.
That's right. So when I was growing up in the 1970s, there was a huge crime wave in the 70s and 80s. There was some real danger. I grew up in a safe suburb, but kids who grew up in New York City, everyone out and played. And just, you know, sometimes you would get mugged, like somebody would threaten you and you'd take your money. And there were crazy people in the 70s. And in New York City, there were serial killers. There was a guy who'd bite people's ears off. I mean, there was all kinds of weird stuff happening. But since then, life has gotten incredibly safe. There was a lot of drunk driving. It used to be in every high school. There'd be some kid died. There'd be memorials because there's always a kid who died drunk driving. Now there are probably more memorials, but it's for suicide. Suicide is way up, whereas deaths from all other causes are way down. So we used to go out in the real world when it had some dangers. In the 90s, the real world got really, really safe. We started locking up drunk drivers in the United States, and so drunk driving is way down. We started locking up. My sister was once flashed. A man just exposed his raincoat, and he was naked underneath. And she was grossed out, but then that was it. Like, the man, you know, it didn't occur to us that we need to, like, file charges and have this man locked up. This sort of thing was tolerated back then, which is terrible. Now those people are all locked up, or they're on Instagram. They're not out there at playgrounds trying to pick up kids. That's really dangerous. They're all on Instagram, where it's perfectly safe. They can make up an alias. No one can find out who they are. They say they're a handsome 14-year-old boy, whatever it is. So what we have to understand here, like, how do we get into this mess where your nephews are sitting there watching other people play video games all day long? How do we get into this? In the 90s was the transition period. We thought the real world was dangerous. And I should say, the same thing goes for Britain. And I should say, a lot of the insights here, especially what you sort of led into the segment with about the loss of trust in each other. Here, I'm taking a lot of this from, you have a wonderful British sociologist, Frank Furedi, who wrote a book called Paranoid Parenting. It's brilliant. But he points to, because you didn't have the same crime that we did in America. I mean, you had some in the 70s, but not as bad as we did. Why did you guys freak out? Why did you guys overprotect your kids in the 90s? There was no reason for it. But what Furedi says is that the central factor is the loss of adult solidarity, that we stopped trusting each other. You had a number of scandals, as we did, where I forget which organizations were accused of child molesting. Some of those were true, some were not. So we begin to think that the real world is really threatening to our kids. And at the same time in the 90s, this amazing thing comes in called the internet. Now, I'm older than you, but I imagine that you remember the first time you saw the internet. How old were you when you first saw a web browser and you could type in questions and the answer comes back instantly? Do you remember?
I think I was about 16, 17, quite young.
Okay. Do you remember being absolutely amazed, or was it just like, yeah. Oh, wow, this is...
I was amazed, yeah.
Okay. So imagine, and you were just 17. Imagine that you were already a full-grown adult and you knew how hard it was to get information. And all of a sudden, God comes down and says, would you like omniscience? Here, omniscience. You can know everything instantly. I mean, this was just like, it was unbelievable. And we thought it was wonderful. And our kids took to it, especially the boys. Early on, boys were always much more interested in hardware. They would build computers and things like that. And early on, they were more interested in the internet. Once social media comes in, then it evens out. But before then, it was more a boy thing. And so our boys are not drunk driving. They're not running around. They're sitting at a computer. That's great. Wow. They're going to get technically skilled. Oh, they're going to have such great careers. And actually, for that first generation, it was true. Those were the millennials. They actually did learn how to use computers. They did learn how to program. That doesn't happen anymore. To use all the social media apps, you don't know any programming. You don't know anything about hardware. My point is, the internet comes in on this tidal wave of optimism and amazement, and we think it's good for the kids. And it might have been. The early internet might have been good for the kids. And that might be part of the reason that the millennials' mental health is actually a little better than Gen X before them. But all that turns around in the 2010s. So we're still super optimistic about tech in 2010, 2011. The Arab Spring is 2011. We think, wow, you know, social media is going to bring down dictators. It's the best thing in the world for democracy. So even 2011, 2012, while the great rewiring is happening, we're still optimistic. And we still think, okay, my nephew is watching other people play video games for 5 hours a day, but, you know, maybe it's stimulating. Like, maybe that's good. Maybe. I don't know. It feels weird, but maybe. Well, now we know it wasn't. It wasn't. Kids need a huge amount of varied experience, most of it in the real world, and they stopped getting that in the early 2010s.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I've got a few more questions on that in a moment, but I did want to ask you about the importance of puberty. Now, I think this is something everyone instinctively knows, that puberty is an incredibly important part of a young person's life. But I want to ask you about just how important it is and the problems that arise when puberty is interfered with in various different ways, or the experiences of puberty are interfered with. So in the book, you talk about slow growth childhood, and you make this really useful observation for a lay person like me about the fact that children grow very rapidly in the first 2 years of life, and then they slow down, kind of take it easy for a while. And then there's another rapid period of growth when they pass the age of 10 or 11 and they start entering sexual maturity. And you talk about puberty as a period in which the brain gets rewired quite rapidly. So things really start to fry and really start to happen. And then, of course, if you introduce certain forms of technology or certain experiences that we literally have puberty blockers for some groups of children, right? So, you know, we have medical interventions that physically prevent the onset of puberty, which I think is very problematic. But there are other ways in which that period of life is interfered with as well. So explain a little bit about why you thought it was important to have that in your book, the importance of puberty and what happens when that moment in life is meddled with to a dangerous degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to write a short book. I wanted to have a chapter on play, and then I wanted to get right to the stuff about phones. But I had to keep expanding the chapter on play. And then I realized, wait, you know, I've really focused on, like, you know, early childhood overprotection, play, risk-taking. I need to talk about puberty. And I put a little section in on puberty, but there's so much to say about puberty that I broke it out into its own chapter. So the two things we really need to focus on are brain changes and enculturation and with identity. So the brain changes are that the human brain and body grow very quickly early on. The brain reaches about 90% of its adult size by the age of 6. So it's not about, like, we don't want our teenagers' brains to grow bigger. They're already but about full size. It's all about pruning and tuning. It's all about, they have too many neurons. The brain, the idea is, let's put too many neurons in there. And then the ones that end up being used and forming circuits, those get reinforced And in puberty, they're going to get myelinated. They're going to get wrapped in a fatty sheath that cements the connection, makes it faster. Whereas the ones that don't get used so much, those are going to literally die and fade away from the brain. Same thing with dendrites, and synapses growing together and connecting. So childhood is a long period of wiring up the brain. It's not about total growth. It's really about what do you connect, what do you cut out. And so the childhood form of the brain has all that stuff in it. At puberty, it's sort of like, okay, now we're going to lock down into the adult configuration. Like now we know how to be. Now let's make it final and make it fast. Make this a much more effective brain. And that rewiring, as I understand it, it begins more in the back of the brain, is the first parts to change over to the adult pattern. And the prefrontal cortex, which is the seat of executive function, conscious thinking, well, you know, a whole bunch of activities, higher mental activities. The prefrontal cortex is the last one to really finish. And that doesn't finish until your late teens or early 20s. So you have all this very, very rapid brain growth going on, brain tuning going on during late childhood and then into puberty. That's the first thing. So right there, that tells you, you know what, we should probably, like, this is probably not a good time to be, you know, drinking heavily when you're like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. This is probably not a good time to have lead hit your brain. Like, you know, the developing brain, you really want to protect it. And so that's the first thing, is just the brain is extra sensitive at puberty because it's like frantically, not frantically, but it's like really in ornate ways getting the microstructure of your adult brain. Okay, now let's talk about culture. At puberty is when kids get more competent. They begin to have adult urges. They are, I shouldn't quite say competent because they are smarter, but they don't have executive control. They don't have much self-control yet. But all around the world at puberty, the parents don't crack down and take more control. Actually, the human pattern is the parents step back and elders of the same sex step in. So all around the world, traditionally, not in modern times as much, but traditionally, when a girl menstruates, that's taken as the start of womanhood. So for girls, it's a very clear biological signal. And on that day, you know, a woman is appointed, you know, if it's someone, it's not never the mother, another woman is appointed for this honored role of basically taking this girl through the puberty rites and leading the rituals and the trials and the dancing and the sacred knowledge and all the things that it takes to turn a girl into a woman. All that is done by older women. And then she is welcomed into the world of women. For boys, it's a little different because boys don't have anything like menstruation. So for boys, it tends to be more like you take all the kids who are a certain size or all the kids who are, you know, around 11, 12, and they become a class of initiates. And then they go through various rituals and ordeals. In a warrior culture, it can be quite brutal to toughen them. So human wisdom and human evolution, cultural evolution, usually has this thing about helping kids make the transition from boy to man and girl to woman. Now, we dropped that a long time ago in the West. We don't do much of that. That was commented on in the early 20th century, that we don't do that much anymore. I had a bar mitzvah, which had a little bit of that, but it wasn't that deep. It wasn't like a big, you know, it was something. It was a rite of passage. You know, you're said, you know, today you are a man. Not that you're really a man, but you have taken on certain responsibilities of a Jewish adult. So there's a little of it in religion, but not much. And so we already stopped guiding our kids through. Then something terrible happened. Rather than them getting it from other kids and from television, now television was all created by older people, by adults, and there were censors. You wouldn't see beheadings on television. You wouldn't see a cat in a blender on television. But instead, we say, how about if the internet raises them? How about if the internet tells them what is, you know, what's the way to be? How about if TikTok guides them through literally, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of very short little videos, depending on your feed, you know, for some of the boys who are more likely to click on stuff, it'll have car crashes, people getting punched in the face, a lot of violence, a lot of sex, a lot of really degrading content. For the girls, many of them are on either, you know, Instagram Reels or TikTok mental health channels. So they're being raised by young women, a little older than them, who have very extreme psychiatric symptoms, not exactly faked, but sort of trained by the audience capture to be more extreme. So our children are now being socialized, not by elders, but by random weirdos on the internet who are selected by algorithm for the extremity of their illness or their views, and then push down the throats of our kids, almost not quite in the same way that we fatten up a goose for you know, foie gras, but it's just a terrible way to have kids go through that delicate time of puberty.
Yeah. I mean, when you put it like that, it's so clear. And like you, I had some of those kind of rituals of childhood and teenage life. I had a Catholic confirmation, which was the moment at which you become an adult in the eyes of the church, or kind of an adult. So there was an element of that. And they were very helpful experiences. There were these kind of signs in the road as you steered your rocky way from childhood to adulthood, and the adult world was generally there to kind of push you in the right direction. And when that goes missing, obviously lots of things can potentially go wrong. I want to ask you about your phrase experience blockers, because I think it's a very useful way to understand some of the problems that you talk about in the book. And you talk about overprotection as an experience blocker. Because kids, you say kids are anti-fragile, and therefore it's useful, it's good, in fact, for them to be exposed to conflict and tension and fear even, and all these things that we think are...
In the real world, yes.
In the real world, yeah, exactly. In the real world, in the concrete world of things and people, it's good for them to have those experiences because it helps them to develop further their skills of anti-fragility and their strength and so on. So you talk about overprotection as an experience blocker because it prevents them from having those experiences and stunts their moral growth as a consequence. And you talk about, you have a section in the book, experience blockers, safetyism and smartphones. And it's a really interesting section. And we've touched on safetyism, and we've touched on smartphones. But I want to ask you a bit more about those two experience blockers in particular. Well, firstly, what exactly do you mean by an experience blocker? And out of those two, safetyism and smartphones, which do you think is the more problematic, or is it an equal relationship with those things?
Yeah. It's hard to quantify, but I'll say a few words and then I'll give an opinion about which is the more powerful one. I can summarize the book by saying we have overprotected our children in the real world. We have underprotected them online. When we overprotect in the real world, we are denying them experience. So I'm all for making kids wear a bike helmet. Go out and ride your bicycle, but wear a helmet so you don't get a concussion. That's great. But I'm opposed to saying, don't ride your bicycle because you might be abducted. And that's what a lot of parents are doing. So the fear, the overprotection, is blocking our kids from riding. Bicycles used to be a part of life. A lot of kids commuted to school on bicycle. I rode to school on my bicycle for part of my education. But that's rare now. Parents drive their kids to school. And so overprotection clearly blocks out most of the exciting, thrilling, interesting, independence-building aspects of life. So that's pretty clear. Safetyism is an experience blocker in the real world. Now, when you give your kid a phone, same thing for an iPad. If you give your kid a personal device that they keep with them, they can customize, they can text, they get their feed, they can create an Instagram account, a TikTok account. They have 15 different channels of stuff coming in. It's all so interesting, and it evolves. In the business world, you know, there's the cultural evolution of products to be more and more addictive, hooky, enticing. So it's far, far more appealing than television was when I was a kid. You know, there were about 5 channels, and they're mostly for adults, and it wasn't that interesting. When you give your kid a phone or their own iPad, that's going to basically take up most of their attention, like literally most. The numbers in the U.S. now are 5 hours a day is the average amount of time that American teenagers spend just on social media. That's just social media, 5. When you add in all the other stuff, numbers go from 7 to 9, something like that. But, you know, half the kids say that they are online almost constantly, which means if you include the time that they're not literally looking at the phone, but they're thinking about it and then they bring it out again back and forth, you know, it can add up to something like 16 hours a day of basically living in the virtual world. And what does that come at the expense of? If you're going to spend 10 to 16 hours a day on something, there's no time for anything else. And so everything else has to get squished down or eliminated. Here's some things that we know get eliminated. Friends. Time with friends has plummeted. It's down more than 50%. I think it's over 60% since 2010. So American teens don't spend very much time physically with their friends. And if they're with their friends, they're both on their phones, so they're not really even talking. So time with friends, you lose out on all of that. reading books. Reading has been declining since the 70s, reading books, but it really plummets after 2010. Because again, there's no time. Religion plummets. Who has time to go to church? And here we're talking about adults as well. A really surprising finding. You know, you may have heard that sex is declining, that young people are having less sex. Something about dating, like maybe changes in dating, what's going on there. But one finding I've come across is that married people are having less sex. So married people have more sex than single people because they have a reliable partner there every night. So married people tend to have regular sex and single people don't. But if you just look at married people are having less sex because no one has time. Everyone is giving 3 to 5 hours a day to these various digital pursuits. There's no time. People are fragmented, exhausted. So that's what I mean by an experience blocker. It's an experience blocker for adults too. It's obviously a sex blocker. I think a lot of adults will recognize the sex blocking effects of phones. What we need is our kids to have more experience in the real world. So let's stop being so safetyist and less total experience in the virtual world. So let's not give them a phone until they're much older.
Absolutely. I did want to ask you about, you mentioned their television. And when you were growing up and when I was growing up, we watched a lot of TV. And I've heard you get a little bit frustrated when people say to you, isn't too much time on your phone just like us lot when we spent too much time watching TV? And our parents would often say to us, turn off that TV, and they'd unplug it and send you outside, which sadly parents are less likely to do today. But you will know that there were previous conversations about too much television. And before that, reading comic books in the early 20th century, you know, why are boys reading these terrible comic books? So there have always been conversations about the role of media in young kids' lives. So explain to us, and I've heard you explain that phones are different. Phones play a different role in a kid's life than a television set or a comic or anything else that they might have had in the past. So explain a little bit about why you think looking at a phone for numerous hours a day is different to the things that we got up to with media when we were younger.
Sure. This is the main argument against me. There are about 6 or 8 researchers who claim that I have mistaken correlation for causation. I'm fomenting a moral panic. This moral panic will be just like the others. Comic books didn't lead anybody to kill their parents. You know, there might have been some story in the news about a kid who did it, but that it was going to be in the garbage press and it wasn't probably real. So there have been many moral panics, and that's a perfectly reasonable starting position. And in the before COVID, in 2018, 2019, when I really started getting into this research, that was the dominant view among researchers, that this is just like all the previous ones. And there's no need to do anything. Well, this is different for a lot of reasons. So I'll just give you two differences that tell you that this is really different. One is that in previous moral panics, almost nobody actually knew anyone personally who was harmed. It was, I read a story about a kid in Surrey who chopped up his mother. It was stories like that propagated by the media. But this time around, everybody knows someone who's been harmed by social media. Most parents that I talk to, you know, about half of them say they see it in their own children, especially their daughters. Everyone is at a school where someone committed suicide. Someone killed themselves because of, not everybody, but suicide is very, very common. It's up more than 50% since 2010 for American teens. Everyone knows someone who's been severely bullied, who's been sextorted, who's been sexually harassed. So this is everywhere. That wasn't the case with previous moral panics. The second difference is that in previous moral panics, you know, when you talk to the kids, they didn't generally say, oh yeah, you know, this is really destroying us. You know, we might have joked around and said, yeah, it's rotting my brain, but we didn't really believe it. We liked television. Now, also, we were playing outside as well. So, you know, I mean, two or 3 hours of television a day, as long as you're also playing outside, is probably fine. But this time around, talk to members of Gen Z. They are not in denial. They see that this is messing them up. When you survey the older members of Gen Z, they generally say they wish that TikTok and Instagram were never invented. They say these things harmed us. My life would have been better if I hadn't been on it. There was a very sad profile in the Times, the UK, the Times, of about 10 UK kids talking about their online lives, and all of them were tragic. Not a one said, oh, it's so exciting and wonderful. I get to meet up with my friends. It was especially the girls were saying, you know, when I was 11, I got onto this platform, Omegle, and it was like guys masturbating. Like, I wish I had not been exposed to that when I was 11. So this is really different from previous moral panics, you know, and, you know, it stands to reason. If you think about, you know, watching television when we were kids, you know, I spent a lot of time watching television. We had limits on it, but I'd spend a lot of time watching television with my sisters or with my best friend. And so you're joking about it, you're talking about it, you know, you're teasing each other, you go get food, you go outside. I mean, it was part of the day, but we were together. Contrast that with a boy today. The boys are all on the multiplayer video games. So if you want to see your friends, you can't go over to their houses. You have to go home alone, because then you have your headset, your controller, your screen, and then you can interact as part of a team in Fortnite or any of the other games. So these new technologies are much more powerful. They're totally customized. I mean, sure, television is trying to keep us on, but like they're showing us advertisements for a Chevrolet, you know, or for a laundry detergent. Like, that's not going to keep us on. Whereas, you know, TikTok is as super customized as it can possibly be to keep you, exactly that person, hooked. So this technology is very different. And we didn't see a huge sudden increase in a single year in mental illness the way we do with the social media era.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
Yeah, I mean, it's just undeniable that television, and I'm sure some kids did watch too much television, but television was a collective experience. It was a family experience.
It was more collective. Sometimes kids would veg out, but it was more collective. Yeah.
Yeah. We, you know, I grew up in a large family and we watched TV together, all eight of us, as a large number of people, talking about it, making jokes about it, eating food while we watched it, as you say. And it was a collective experience, because often it would be the big show that everyone in the country was watching. So then you could talk to your friends at school about it as well, and what's going to happen next. So there was a shared experience on TV, whereas with a lot of social media and a lot of phone use, it facilitates a retreat from the family and a retreat from the social sphere into a world in which you are bombarded as a fragile or as an exposed individual to all these different dangerous, weird ideas. But you mentioned there causation and correlation, and I did want to ask you about that specifically. And I guess one of the questions I had for you was, I find so much of what you write about in the book in relation to the changing nature of childhood and the changing experience of childhood so convincing. And I wanted to ask you about what happens in 2010 and 2012, and you get phones, and then you describe that there is this quite sudden and quite rapid change in the mental health of young people in particular. I wanted to ask you, I guess, is the iPhone the cause of those problems, or is it itself a response to those problems? So is it exacerbating these tensions within modern childhood, or is it a technology that has molded itself around a pre-existing problem in kids, which is, you know, the mollycoddled and exposed to ideas about mental ill health and so on. So what exactly do you think the role of the iPhone is in contributing to all these problems that you've been talking about?
Sure. So the iPhone is one of the greatest inventions in human history, as is the internet. The iPhone is an amazing digital Swiss Army knife. And when I got mine in 2008, the second year of the iPhone, I was in awe. You know, I love gadgets. When I was a kid, I always had a Swiss Army knife. It's got like the magnifying glass and the fish scaler and the tweezers. And it was so much fun to have like, all these tools. And it's also a real boy thing. Like boys want like a toolbox. They want a tool thing. And so I found the iPhone to be just amazing. And in 2008, there was no App Store. There was no push notification. It was a digital Swiss Army knife that I used when I wanted something. If I wanted a flashlight, it had a flashlight on it. So I don't think that the iPhone, and when we say iPhone, we're including obviously all the Samsung, it's just the different ecosystem. But the smartphone was an amazing technology. Now, then some things change. The App Store, I think, does come out at some point in 2008. Push notifications begin, I think, maybe 2009, plus or minus. And social media goes super viral, or it becomes super viral, in 2009. Before the retweet button, you couldn't blow up the world in a few hours. People had to copy and paste and resend. So when Twitter invented the retweet button, Facebook invented the like button, they copy each other's innovations, everything now gets super viralized. Everything's very explosive. Social media is no longer about me connecting with your page. It's now about the news feed and can I make my post go viral? So is this the fault of the iPhone? Well, the iPhone certainly was a platform that allowed extraordinary innovation. And, you know, as has generally been the case with the internet, it starts off as this dream of distributed everything and everyone is welcome and it's free and no one can control it. I had a conversation with a friend of mine in 1995 trying to explain, he was looking for an investment angle. And I said, well, that's the great thing about the internet. You can't make money with it because, you know, like people put things out for free. You can't charge people for it. It's just information. Boy, was I wrong. In any case, the point is that once you get companies competing, you get a few companies rising to dominance. And the internet that emerges by 2010, controlled by a couple of companies, is very different than the utopian dream, libertarian dream that we had of the internet in the 90s. So that's why so much is changing. I don't exactly blame the phone. I think Apple, you know, I get the sense Apple is at least trying. I mean, the screen time controls get better and they do get better. Apple could really help us out a lot. They could make phones that parents could designate as a child's phone. There are all kinds of things I suggest in my book. There's a lot that Apple and Google and Microsoft could do to help us parents get some semblance of control and raise our kids the way we want to. But I think it's really more about the applications and then it's the total life. That's why I really try to say over and over again, I'm not talking about social media destroying a generation. I'm talking about the phone-based childhood. If you have a phone-based childhood, you're not going to have healthy children. If you have a play-based childhood, you will have healthy children. So it's the transformation of life. And I forgot to answer your question before. You said, which one is bigger? I didn't really know, but as I've been doing the international research with Zach Rausch, my lead researcher, what we found is that in Scandinavia and in New Zealand, where they still let their kids out, those are places that didn't go in for the overprotection. They have very high trust, very high social capital. Kids in New Zealand, it's the only English-speaking country where kids are allowed to climb a tree at recess. Everywhere else it's been banned because it's too dangerous. But New Zealand, they still let their kids out. And Scandinavia and the Nordic countries. But when we look at the mental health stats, the same thing happens at the same time. The girls in all those countries begin self-harming a lot more by 2014, 2015, even though they were let out as children. So that's why I think that both matter. But, you know, in terms of which one really pushed them over into mental illness and, you know, just miserable, lonely lives. I actually think it's the move on to the phones is the bigger one.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the question that one is not meant to ask, which is how real is the mental illness crisis? Now, it's very real in the sense that there are significant numbers of young people who experience their difficulties in life as a form of mental illness, who feel lonelier than before. And you describe it all in your book. I mean, that's a very real phenomenon. And most listeners will recognize what you're describing straight away. But is what the anxious generation suffering from, is it mental illness? Or is this part of a pattern that you will be familiar with of pathologizing experiences that were traditionally seen as part of the human domain? Sadness, happiness, anxiety, shyness, awkwardness, even depression. I don't mean in the clinical sense, but a kind of feeling very down one day and feeling quite up the next. You know, one thing that really worries me about TikTok, and I talked about this on BBC Radio a couple of years ago, is that there's now this trend on TikTok alongside all the other crazy stuff that boys see and which girls are exposed to, and the kind of very strange gender fluid ideologies that are tempting children to to supposedly change their gender and so on. Alongside all of that, there's another trend of TikTok where there are these very short videos that will say, do you have the four following symptoms? And it will list perfectly ordinary symptoms, like sometimes I feel like crap. And then if you have these four symptoms, it says you may have bipolar disorder. So how do you distinguish between, I mean, it's not a nice thing to say, but a kind of genuine mental ill health and a kind of pathologized experience of life? Is it important, do you think, to maintain that kind of distinction?
Oh, no, we have to focus on that. And that is such an important question that we address that in the Coddling the American Mind, because we have a whole chapter on anxiety and we show the beginnings of the graphs. You know, we had data up until about 2016, 2015, 2016, because the book came out in 2018. So we show the graphs and then we consider that hypothesis. And we also, in the Coddling, we also have a long section on concept creep. Concepts in psychology have creeped, and they generally, interestingly, they always creep in a leftward direction. So they creep towards, you know, the more, you know, more mental illness, more racism, more bullying. Nick Haslam, a great Australian psychologist, coined the term and shows how this has changed in clinical psychology. So that is certainly what you're saying, certainly is happening. And that could explain some of the rise in self-reports of mental illness, especially anxiety, depression. So then you compare that to behavior, to behavioral measures that are not self-report. And the clearest one is self-harm. And because there we have, in Britain, there's a study that looked at doctors' records. These were filled out by the doctors, not by the patients. In America, we have the CDC keeps track of reasons for hospitalization so they can pick up if like suddenly people are coming in with this thing, the CDC can catch it. So they have good coding of self-harm behavior. And there too, we see this, we see the same shape curves. Now, then some people argue, well, but, you know, the diagnostic criteria changed and it was global. There was a global change. Yeah, in 2015, the ICD, the International Consortium, whatever it is, there are some changes in diagnostic criteria that the clinicians are supposed to use. But the only one that was really global is 2015. And this thing is really underway by then. So, you know, if listeners go to afterbabble.com, that's my Substack, we have so many posts there addressing all of these criticisms and showing that none of them can explain what happened. None of them work for multiple countries. Almost none of them have the timing right. And so, you know, there's like so many people are motivated to deny that there even is a mental health crisis. Talk to anyone who works with kids. Talk to any teacher. Talk to any principal. Talk to psychologists. Talk to the track coach. Talk to employers about their Gen Z students. We're not all imagining this. This is not just that the kids are self-reporting. Something really changed for people, for humans in the developed world born after 1995.
Okay, John, my last question for you. I want to just ask you about where you think things are at on university campuses. So the Coddling of the American Mind was such an important contribution to this discussion. The things that you've written on cancel culture, the things that Greg Lukianoff has been doing with FIRE, and I've always seen cancel culture as an extension of precisely the trends that you've just been talking about and that you write about in The Anxious Generation, because like the more that young people see themselves as hyper fragile and vulnerable, the more they're going to use the shield of censorship against anything that they might see as harmful to their self-esteem. So it's very intimately related. I did want to ask you about what you think is happening with some of the protests that we've seen on American campuses and British campuses as well in relation to Gaza, because it does seem to me, on the one hand, I'm quite happy to see that some university administrators and some student radicals are finally standing up for the ideals of freedom of speech in relation to the right to protest against Israel. But these are the very same people who for a long time said,
yeah,
that,
you know, we're shutting it down for anything else.
And a white guy wearing a sombrero was a crime against culture. And, you know, if you go on campus and say men can't become women, you have to be banned. So there's a staggering level of hypocrisy. So do you see any positivity in the fact that people are standing up for freedom of speech? Or do you just think there is a real cynicism to what's going on campuses?
Yeah, no, they're not standing up. No. They're not standing up for freedom of speech. They're standing up for their cause, not for freedom of speech. So I'll just give you two thoughts about what's happening. One is, you know, I've been in this from the beginning. I co-founded Heterodox Academy in 2015, Nothing to do with campus protests, nothing to do with students. It was a faculty issue that everyone's on the left. And I said, wait a second, guys, we're not getting the right answers here in psychology if everyone's on the same team. So that was 2015. And then everything blew up. Beginning at Yale, the Halloween costume protests, all that stuff. Every year since from 2015 to 2022, things got worse every single year. It never got better. There was never a turnaround. We never saw university administrators setting limits. Saying, yes, you can protest, but you don't get to shout down speakers. They never said that. They never punished anyone who shouted down speakers, who blocked other people's freedom of speech. And so since they didn't set limits then, they're finding it very hard to set limits now on disruptive protests that are often, of course, most are peaceful. But, if you're a Jewish kid on campus, it doesn't matter that most are peaceful. If you're wearing a yarmulke, you might well get spat on, pushed, punched. So, we're accepting a level of aggression and intimidation that, as you said before, if anybody wears a sombrero or says the wrong word, they're a danger to the campus and they have to be expelled. So there's extraordinary hypocrisy. But what I can say, things began to turn around in 2022 and especially 2023. I write an annual letter for Heterodox Academy for the annual report. And I think my title in January 2023 was "The Fever Has Broken." Because for the first time, we were beginning to see, it was like, because what happened was George Floyd, like things were getting crazy before George Floyd. And then they went like completely bonkers. And all the push for, much more DEI and much more mandatory training and all this stuff, things went bonkers in 2020. And the business world went all in on it. And then the business world realized a year or two later, like, wait a second, this is really backfiring. This is not helping our culture. This is causing constant conflict. Progressive organizations were discovering that they were paralyzed by internal conflict. Everybody was mad at somebody for saying something. So outside the university, the fever broke and they've dialed that back a lot. And I was finally beginning to see some signs of it in 2023. There was an incident at Stanford where a speaker was shouted down with the help of an administrator. And the dean said, no, that was wrong. Like, finally, an adult in the room said, like, no, we don't support shouting down the speakers that we've invited. So there were some signs of hope in 2023. It's also important that trust in higher ed used to be very high, even up to 2015, even on the right. It was, not very high, but it was above 50% approval of higher ed in 2015. It's plummeted, not just for the right, but for centrists and moderates as well. Americans have lost trust. Higher ed used to have a great brand. We've destroyed our brand. That's encouraging, actually, because when we hit rock bottom in December 5th of last year, when those three presidents testified and they couldn't explain anything about why it's wrong to call for genocide of Jews, that was so shameful that I hoped was rock bottom. And now people feel much, I feel much freer to speak. I can speak more honestly than I did before. I was had at least, I knew I was walking on thin ice with a lot of my work. So the fever has broken, things are changing. On the other hand, The Gaza protests are so passionate. Now, a lot of the kids are very misinformed. A lot of them don't understand that they are literally supporting a group that's calling for the elimination of Israel and the death of the Jews. But it is a very passionate activism. And the images on the news, I can understand a large part of the passion. And so that is probably going to change this generation for the rest of their lives, because there's research showing that however the world looks to you between about, 18 and 24, it's kind of a sensitive period for politics. So this will shape many members of Gen Z, especially at elite schools, for the rest of their lives. So we will see the echoes of these protests in much more radical politics on the left. And I think that means that the right is going to be much more successful because of it. Because the reason why so many people are moving rightward in America now, black men, Asians, working class people are leaving the Democratic Party, which was their traditional home, and they're moving to the right, not just in America, in Europe as well. And I think a lot of it is because of the excesses of the left. The right is traditionally, historically, generally a response to the excesses of the left. Now, both sides are crazy, in my view. We've got extremism and illiberalism on both sides. But I do see the campus protests as being, even if the war in Israel and Gaza was resolved very quickly, I think this generation now, because of these protests, are going to be radicalized for a long, long time to come.
John, thank you very much.
Brendan, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe
And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.